Colin, please.
May it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Ryan Martinez, and I represent the appellant, Seaman Richard Mott. Chief Judge Bick, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Please. Grant.
In the interest of time, I plan on addressing only Issue 2 today, but will answer any questions the court may have. The military judge erred here in admitting Seaman Mott's statements because Seaman Mott's mental disease prevented him from knowingly and intelligently waiving his rights.
Before you get into all that, can I just ask about the connection between the two? If you're focusing on Issue 2, does that mean if you win on Issue 2, you don't get to Issue 1? Don't you have to get to Issue 1 then?
Your Honor, yes. For the purposes of the argument, I plan on spending my time on
Issue 2. But it's a package deal. You think the two are... You're not suggesting that...
I'm not conceding Issue 1, Your Honor.
No, but aren't they linked in the sense that even if you win on Issue 2, you have to address Issue 1?
Well, yes and no, Your Honor. I think that goes to really the prejudice with Issue 2, which would, in fact, touch on Issue 1 as well. And the issue there is the prejudice with Issue 2 with the statement coming in is the government, the way the government used the statement and the video together.
Let me ask it a different way. Are you focusing on Issue 2 because you think that that's your stronger argument?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think it's certainly the more fact-intensive issue that needs more time. Certainly not conceding that it's stronger than Issue 1, though.
Well, I'm sorry. Why don't you try your argument?
Yes, sir.
I'll give you a hard time later.
The facts show that the government failed to meet its burden here, and I'd like to highlight four issues from the beginning. First, the forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Sadoff, after reviewing the case file and interviewing Seaman Mott, testified that Seaman Mott did not appreciate his rights or the consequences of waiving them. Second, before and during the interrogation, Seaman Mott suffered from active hallucinations and severe delusions to the point where he was unresponsive to special agents' questions, including the question where the special agent asked Seaman Mott how he felt after stabbing Seaman J.G., and Seaman Mott responded by speaking about why he wanted to change his major back in college. He was unresponsive to the questions. Third, the special agent at the time of the interrogation suspected that Seaman Mott was insane, and after 3 hours of interrogating him when the video started, he questioned Seaman Mott at least three or four different occasions, asking if he was of sound mind. And fourth, after the interrogation, the 706 board found that Seaman Mott was incompetent to stand trial, and specifically, he did not have sufficient mental capacity to understand the nature of the proceedings, meaning he didn't understand or could appreciate his rights, or he was not able to exercise his rights, including the right to remain silent.
Can you, have you found any cases on point, directly on point, rather than through inference, that has addressed Justice Stevens' conundrum, which is, that he identified, which is, how can someone who cannot understand the proceedings against them otherwise knowingly and intelligently waive a right?
No, Your Honor, I have not. But it makes sense that it would seem to be implausible and illogical here to find in this case in particular that Seaman Mott, at the time that the 706 report was done, could not understand his rights or exercise them. But for some reason, we're going to say that at the time that he waived his rights, he was competent to understand those rights. It seems illogical to make that conclusion.
What's the time span there between the time that he was actually interviewed and the time of the 706 board? And did anything that they do go back in time?
Yes, Your Honor. The 706 board took place, I believe it began on 3 April was when the first neurological testing occurred. So it was about three weeks, maybe 4 weeks. But it's consistent with what Seaman Mott was experiencing before and during the interrogation in terms of the active hallucinations, where he apparently heard Seaman J.G. saying that he had to kill Seaman Mott earlier, the day before. Certainly the delusions of the rape that occurred in his mind in 2003. So all these delusions and hallucinations are consistent throughout. And the 706 boards, both at the Butner Federal Medical Center, which had multiple interviews and multiple findings that Seaman Mott was incompetent and that Seaman Mott was unable to appreciate the wrongfulness, it was all basically coalesced and gelled and said the same thing.
So, counsel, if I'm understanding you correctly, instead of you're proposing instead of a totality of the circumstances test to determine whether or not the confession was voluntary, that we're supposed to say he was schizophrenic, full stop, therefore it wasn't voluntary?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. It's the totality of the circumstances. When you look at the totality of circumstances, the evidence is overwhelming in favor of showing that Seaman Ma was not competent.
Well, which finding of fact the military judge made is unsupported by the evidence or obviously wrong?
Yes, Your Honor. There are at least 9 or 11 instances here where the military judge is either incorrect or his findings of ability are erroneous. First, the military judge says that the agent started recording video recording.
Point to specific sentences in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you agree that that's the standard, right? You agree that that's the standard where the military judge abused his discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. The Joint Appendix, page 114, line 3, the judge is saying that the later portion of Seaman Mott's interrogation was recorded on video due to the bizarre nature of his initial statements. That's directly contradicted by the evidence before the military judge, by the government's own witness, who said, no, Your Honor, it was not the fact that his bizarre behavior caused me to start the video. It was because my supervisor and the trial counsel said because of the severity of the crime, that's why we should start the video. And that's at page 56 of the record during the special agent's testimony. Additionally, the military judge...
And that's important because...
Well, for one, Your Honor, it shows the military judge is not... His findings of fact is certainly here are erroneous.
You would agree that an erroneous finding of fact has to be relevant to the decision, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think this is relevant to the decision in terms of when the video was recording, and the video plays a very important role.
Well, you're not disagreeing that the video was recorded. Does it matter why it was recorded? I guess that's my question. Does it matter why it was recorded? Even assuming he's erroneous, does it matter?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it goes to, one, the special agent's thought to begin with, and also it clearly goes to the military judge and what he's doing in these findings of fact. And that's not the only issue. Later on the next page, he says the defense claims the statements were involuntary based on the fact that he could...
Which line, please?
I'm sorry. This is line 30 on 115 of the Joint Appendix. Based on the fact that the accused was mentally ill at the time. And the defense...
Okay, but that's, you'd agree that's not a finding of fact, that's a discussion. I'm asking you which findings of fact and conclusions of law were unsupported by the record or clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. Line 10 on page 114. Before and during the interrogation, the accused's memory and thought processes were functioning and he was able to clearly communicate a logical string. Later on, he says the accused gave logical answers to the questions that were asked. And the record has overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Seaman Mott was asked by the special agent about his feelings about the attack, after the attack. How did you feel? Seaman Mott starts talking about why he wanted to change his major in college. The special agent also asks later on during the video interview, which is important to review because it goes hand in hand with the actual written statement here. And he asks Seaman Mott what should be put in the next paragraph as they're going through the written statement. Seaman Mott seems like he's detached from that conversation. He's talking about the rape back in 2003 when he had to play dead when Seaman Garcia, apparently in his delusions, put the bag over his head to try and kill him. Additionally, Your Honor, the 2003 rape, it's clear that Seaman Mott is completely delusional at this point. He says that Seaman JG put the bag over his head, actually did kill him, and Seaman Mott was resurrected, came back to life. I think his quote was, he was zapped back to life. So he's telling the agent at that time that he was killed in 2003 and came back to life and was resurrected. This goes to show that he's not thinking logically. Also, during the video, you can see that the special agents, when they're talking to Seaman Mott, are explaining to him how to sign the written statement. We don't have the video showing what happened during the rights waiver, which would be great evidence here for us to take a look at. What we do have is, at the time that he signed his written statement and initialed his written statement, how Seaman Mott was acting. And the agents had to tell Seaman Mott on at least 3 or 4 different occasions what to do. And he seems confused during this time. He doesn't understand what's going on. Where he's supposed to sign, the agent had to go back and correct him multiple times and say, no, you have to sign here. You have to put your initials here. This all goes to show that he's not thinking logically, as the military judge found. There's also the fact that he has active hallucinations. The fact that he heard Seaman J.G. say the day before that he was going to kill him. We also have the fact that he's saying that President Clinton and then Governor Bush called him on the phone. They had a conversation that the Special Forces, U.S. Special Forces, kidnapped him when he was 13 and they broke his neck. So all of these show that he's not only confused, he's detached from reality. The conversation with the agents where he starts talking about these mushroom spores are really really go to that as well, where he says that, yes, I have these spores that I'm growing to create mushrooms. And the agent says, well, why? He says, well, I'm going to sell those mushrooms to a hospital for medicinal purposes. And the agent asks him, well, how is that possible? And he says, well, I'm going to build a hospital. So he's telling the agent he's going to build a hospital to sell mushroom spores to. And the agent questions him and says, well, you know, by the time that those spores are, by the time you're done with the hospital, the spores are going to be dust. And this, again, in the video, confuses Seaman Mott.
What about law and conclusions of law? Did the military judge get any of those incorrect from your standpoint?
Well, Your Honor, certainly, and there's two different findings here. We have the findings on the record, which is set in open court, and then you have the written findings as well. The ruling and the written finding for the government satisfied its burden by proof that the statement was voluntary and reliable. The ruling only talks about the knowing and intelligent component during the trial on the record. And there, he's very conclusory. There's no meaningful analysis of what facts he used on the record to find that Seaman Mott understood. All he says is it's clear to the court that Seaman Mott understood the rights and consequences. Then 23 days later, he submits this written finding of fact and written conclusions of law, and those are not in there. And it's also worth noting to the court that in his findings of fact and conclusions, there's no mention at all that the special agent suspected at the time during the interrogation that Seaman Mott was insane. There's no mention of that in the record, or I'm sorry, in the written findings, or on the record for his findings. And additionally, there's no mention at all that Dr. Sadoff's testimony. So the medical evidence that we have here, that Dr. Sadoff is saying at the time of the interrogation, Seaman Mott was psychotic, he was detached from reality, it affected him intellectually, cognitively, and emotionally. And he did not understand the questions despite us thinking that he did understand.
Absolutely. He did sign a rights waiver, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
And what evidence is there that there was police coercion of any sort to get this particular confession? Is there any evidence of that?
Well, Your Honor, it's questionable as to whether or not if the agent suspected that Seaman Mott was insane at the time. And again, we only saw the video.
I mean, you have to focus on the law. I mean, you have to focus on the Connolly opinion and not what Justice Stevens wrote in the concurrence somewhere. Okay, so based on what the law is, opposed to the facts that show that he is schizophrenic, okay, based on what the law is, how is this an involuntary confession, other than the fact that he was insane?
Yes, Your Honor, there's two components.
But you agree that the fact that he's schizophrenic alone doesn't make this an involuntary statement?
Totally agree that just his severe mental disease does not win the day, that alone. But if you look
at all the facts that you're focusing on are evidence of his mental disease.
Your Honor, they're evidence that he was not thinking logically. He did not understand what was going on at the time, but he was detached from reality. He could not.
But the test is, did he understand the right that he was giving up?
Right, Your Honor. And the evidence here shows that he did not. That he was not.
What is the evidence that he did not understand that particular fact, which is a salient fact?
Your Honor, the fact that the medical expert testified that he was detached from reality, the fact that during the interrogation he's clearly hallucinating and delusional at the time, the fact that he's unable to sign the written statement without direction, constant direction by the agents, the fact that the special agent himself suspected that he was insane. So all those facts go to the point that we have to have those two components here. Whether or not he voluntarily waived his rights, which if we look back at Burbine, you see the two distinct dimensions, the voluntariness in the sense that it was free of coercion, which here the argument could be as well, that if the agent knew that Seaman Mott was potentially insane and still questioned him hours after that knowledge, where do we draw the line there?
Now, do you have any case law to support that argument?
No, Your Honor. But the second prong, besides the voluntariness, Your Honor, is the fact that he had a full awareness of both the nature of the right being abandoned and the consequences. So voluntariness alone is not what the court also needs to look at, whether or not he had a full awareness of that right. And here the evidence shows that he did not have a full awareness of that right. And the medical evidence supports that as well. And that medical evidence was evidence that the military judge did not even comment on in his findings of fact, aside from the 706 report.
Counsel, assuming arguendo that he couldn't waive his rights, why isn't this HBRD?
Yes, Your Honor.
You got a bunch of eyewitnesses to the offense. You know, why isn't this harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, Your Honor, because the trial counsel and government used both the written statement and the video of the interview throughout their entire case and made it the centerpiece of their case. They also used it to counter the mental insanity defense. And that's the real harm here, is that
Wait a minute. Are you going back to one now?
No, Your Honor.
Because in one, you know, in your brief, you concede that he appreciated the nature and quality of his conduct in attacking Seaman Garcia.
Yes, Your Honor. You
conceded that in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. He knew that he was attacking Seaman Garcia.
He knew he was attacking Seaman Garcia.
Yes, Your Honor. But in terms of the prejudice, in terms of issue two,
right.
The fact that the trial counsel on 15 different occasions during the closing and rebuttal argument mentioned the statement, mentioned the written statement, and the video of the interrogation. The fact that he quoted from the statement in order to get the conviction. The fact that he said the video and statement are the best sources of the thought process of Seaman Mott.
Well, doesn't that run counter to your argument, which is that the statement and the video show that he was completely nuts?
Yeah, you can't have it both ways.
Your Honor, but the way it worked out in trial, however, is that the trial counsel said, members, look at this video. This shows that Seaman Mott wasn't raving mad. He wasn't completely out of his mind. So he's perpetuating these false stereotypes of mental disease to show the members.
Well, wait a minute. You can't have it both ways. You've just been talking about how this video shows he's a raving lunatic and is incapable of understanding what he was waving. And now you're saying that the trial counsel effectively used this same video to show that he was fully appreciative of it. You can't have it both ways.
Yes, Your Honor. And the difference is that the trial counsel is using the symptoms of Seaman Mott's paranoid schizophrenia against him. And the evidence shows that with paranoid schizophrenia, you have a quiet or slow affect, that these things are caused by the disease. The trial counsel is saying, listen, members, if you find him insane, he has to be totally raving mad. And that's not the case. It's not what the doctors testified to, and it's not what medical science has told us. So those are two distinctions there, Your Honor. But the fact that it was so prejudicial to, I see my time has expired.
Yeah, please continue.
The fact that admitting the statement was so prejudicial to Seaman Mott, looking at the video, looking at the written statement, this is the centerpiece of the government's case, which is prevalent throughout and certainly in the closing, that this is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Judge Efron? A couple questions. Is it the defense position that a person who is declared incompetent to assist in his own trial is incompetent in all cases to waive rights on an interrogation? Or is your argument that there are specific circumstances in this case which would apply to the issue of his inability to waive his rights?
Yes, Your Honor, there are specific circumstances here because we're looking at the totality of the evidence. I'm not asking for a bright-line rule that would be the case where if you are found incompetent to stand trial by a 706 board, that means that you would never be able to waive your rights, because you potentially could, and the doctor even testified that that's a possibility. But in this case, after reviewing the evidence and after interviewing Seaman Mott, that was not the actual finding here. So that goes as part of the totality of the evidence here, which is overwhelmingly in favor of finding that Seaman Mott was not competent and was unable to understand his rights.
And the second question is, if this court determines that the statements should be suppressed, Does the prejudice on that go to the entire conviction or only to the issue of premeditation?
It should go to the issue of premeditation. It should also go to the issue of the mental insanity defense, because we don't know what the members would have found absent the written statement and absent the video.
So that's your link to the other issue. If we disagree with you on that, can the sentence to findings of unpremeditated attempt be affirmed either here or at the Court of Criminal Appeals?
I'm sorry.
If this court determines that those are not linked, but that the statement should be suppressed, can a finding of attempted unpremeditated murder be affirmed either here at the Court of Criminal Appeals, or is a rehearing required?
No, Your Honor, a rehearing would be required, because that would dynamically change the landscape of the entire case. The defense had to prepare for a court-martial knowing that the statement was coming in because the motion was denied. So that changes potentially the tactics of the defense as well as their ability to present their mental insanity.
But that would be the case in any circumstance in which a statement is suppressed, and yet the mere suppression of a statement does not necessarily require a rehearing in every case. What distinguishes this particular case?
Your Honor, here, because the statement and the video, both of them together, were used and intertwined by the government in its case, it permeated the entire case, and to take it out now would significantly alter the court-martial, and we would have to have a rehearing to determine whether or not the members...
And how would that alter the court-martial with respect to unpremeditated murder, putting aside the other issue on the insanity defense as a whole?
Sorry,
that is, why is unpremeditated murder prejudiced by the admission of the statement?
You know, I think it goes to many things if you look at the written statement and the actual interrogation in terms of the glass of water that Simamat apparently drank before the attack. It goes to the elements of the actual offense. So that would affect that charge as well.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, can I ask you to address one thing? When you... I'm not sure of where this is in the joint appendix, but when the judge recalled Dr. Sadoff,
yes, Your Honor,
in his testimony on page 81 and 82, 83 of the transcript, if you could address his answers in those particular things to the military judge's questions as to whether or not he answered questions appropriately, whether he understood them intellectually, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the testimony...
I'm rebuttal.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
If you're ready to do it now, you can do it now, and then the government can respond to you. So go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the testimony there was that Dr. Sadoff testified that Seaman Mott didn't have the ability to emotionally appreciate...
But that wasn't my... I mean, he asked whether or not, if your impression was that the accused understood the questions being asked by NCS, right? That was the question. The doctor's answer was, I think intellectually he did, yes. Right?
Yes, sir.
And then the military judge said, and he gave appropriate responses to the questions that were being asked. As far as I could tell, yes.
Okay, in some cases, rather.
I'm just reading from the doctor's testimony that you're relying on to say that he didn't understand it.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your response?
My response, Your Honor, is the fact that he does say that in terms of the intellectual versus the emotional difference there is a difference. And whether or not he can intellectually answer a question, that appears to us that he's
so following. If he intellectually understood the answers to the questions, your concern is that he didn't emotionally, intuitively internalize them?
Well, potentially, Your Honor, but also the other evidence showing that his logical responses to some of these questions by the agents contradict even that testimony, that he's not logically responding to the questions, that he's really talking about back in 2003 when this alleged rape occurred in his delusion. So he's not responsive to those questions. That is to go to show that he does not logically understand or follow all the questions that were asked. Now, it appears sometimes that he does for many of the questions, but certainly not all.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions before? Thank you very much. Counsel for the government, please.
May it please the Court, my name is Major William Kirby, and I, along with Colonel Stephen Newman, represent the United States government. This Court should affirm the lower court's decision for the following two reasons. First, when defining moral lawfulness, the courts have consistently applied the objective standard, and since the IDRA's passing, no court has applied this objective standard. And two, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting appellant's confession, as the military judge's detailed findings of fact were well supported by the record, not clearly erroneous, and he properly weighed the totality of the circumstances. With regards to AOE 1, this court should follow the circuit court's lead in finding that the objective standard applies when defining moral wrongfulness.
Can you define in plain English what the essential dispute between appellant and the government is on this issue?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in defining moral wrongfulness. The military judge gave the instruction that moral wrongfulness was contrary to public morality. The appellant asked for moral wrongfulness to be defined as contrary to personal or subjective standards of morality. That has not been in common law, nor in the codification of the IDRA, or in the federal circuits.
And do I understand that you are in favor of whatever one describes it as the Queen's Bench answer, which you quote in your brief? If under the influence of his delusion he supposes another man to be in the act of attempting to take away his life and he kills that man as he supposes in self-defense, he would be exempt from punishment?
Yes, Your Honor, that is part of the McNaughton rule.
Okay, the part I don't understand is, why is that objective? The part about society's standards is objective.
Yes, Your Honor.
But are you then supposed to apply the delusions as that person perceives them?
Yes,
or what a normal person would perceive them as?
Well, Your Honor, the standard, as the military judge pointed out, the standard focuses on the accused's ability to appreciate that his conduct was contrary to public or societal standards. So there's two parts to that standard, Your Honor. There's the accused's ability to appreciate. That accounts for the subjective element that appellant is asking for. Those words, appreciate his conduct. So that accounts for his subjective understanding. What we are contrasting his appreciation against is the objective standard, the wrongfulness, Your Honor. And that historically has been defined as...
Okay, let me ask my question another way. It's not a trick question. I'm really trying to understand it, whether it's objective, subjective, subject, or objective. This is a quote from Ewing, and it's the court speaking. Here a person is criminally responsible regardless of his appreciation of his act's legal wrongfulness, which is the objective piece. If he is aware at the time of the offending act that society morally condemns such acts. Okay, that's objective.
Yes, sir.
That court then goes on to say, or the Queen's Bench says, whether society would judge his actions in appropriate response to his delusions.
Yes, sir.
You're supposed to, you take into account his delusions.
Yes, Your Honor. In other words...
And apply it against the objective standard.
Yes. What the McNaughton case was discussing there was assuming his delusions were real.
Did the judge in this case tell the members to apply the objective standard against this defendant's delusions?
Yes, Your Honor. And in that, he stated specifically whether or not it was his ability to appreciate that his conduct would be contrary to public or standard morality. His delusions were included in the evidence given to the members. That evidence went before the members. Whether or not he appreciated accounts for that subjective element that you're discussing, Your Honor. And then the other part is that to contrast that against the public morality is the definition of the
morality. Didn't the defense concede that he appreciated that his conduct contravened public morality? But what they're saying, what they're maintaining, is that nonetheless his notion that his personal morality trumped public morality gets him off?
Well, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor. But the other part to that is also that this, what the appellant asked for was an instruction pertaining to wrongfulness, defining wrongfulness. And he asked that wrongfulness be defined with a subjective standard. In other words, his perception of morality should trump.
That's what I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm on a separate issue, by the way, just to be clear. I'm not doing the morality, non-morality thing. I'm focusing on what role his delusions should play, whether the members should take into account what a normal person would perceive at that time or what a person with these delusions would perceive when applying the objective standard, society's standard of behavior.
Yes, yes,
you say society's standard of behavior as applied to someone who perceives X, or is it society's standard of behavior as to what a normal person would perceive in a mess deck?
Yes, sir.
It doesn't change the outcome necessarily. I'm just trying to figure out what test to apply.
Well, the test to apply, Your Honor, is the objective standard. That's specifically what occurred in the McNaughton case.
Right, but against what a normal person would have been perceiving at that time, or what this particular person was perceiving at that time?
Well, Your Honor, the standard as given, it defines, again, it goes back to his ability to appreciate. So it appreciates, as you're talking about, it incorporates his delusions, it incorporates his thought process at that time, his subjective beliefs in that first portion with his ability to appreciate. Whether contrasting that subjective or his delusions against is, again, did he know that what he was doing he ought not to do, as the courts have held in the past? In other words, under his delusions, did he appreciate that society would condemn his actions? And that's historically what the courts have done, Your Honor. Whether it be the McNaughton case or how the common law has developed post-McNaughton rule, the courts have historically held that if an appellant has a delusion, his appreciation of his conduct should be contrasted against society's public morality. In other words, does he understand that he ought not to do that action? Again, under Article 50 Alpha, mental responsibility is defined as a result of mental illness, the appellant was unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of his act. Again, we can see, the government sees that appellant was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia at the time of his attack on the victim. However, we get to the second prong, which is, was he unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his act? Obviously, again, Your Honor, when you talk about the subjective-objective hybrid standard that the appellant asked for here, actually is already incorporated into the test because the subjective element falls under the word appreciate, as this court pointed out in Martin. And the actual contrast that public morality, how we define wrongfulness, is the objective standard. That was what came from the McNaughton rule, Your Honor. And as the IDRA codified, and this court pointed out in Martin, the IDRA codified the McNaughton rule, taking the elements from that. And historically, the objective standard has been applied to defining wrongfulness. An appellant is entitled to an instruction under the proper instruction under the law. The law has been and has continued to be, as other circuit courts have continued to point out post-IDRA, that wrongfulness is defined with the objective standard. We look to public morality to define that term. The military judge in this case, Your Honor, gave the proper instruction. Appellant objected to that instruction. There was a discussion. Appellant did not offer a subjective standard instruction. Instead, he debated with the military judge, and the military judge came back with the objective standard instruction and gave that instruction to the members after the members asked for what does the term wrongfulness mean in this case. And the military judge gave the proper instruction. This court should, again, follow the lead of the circuit courts, the 7th, the 9th. We have multiple circuits and also state courts who have looked at Ewing's analysis of the McNaughton rule at the IDRA and have interpreted that, indeed, the IDRA defines the term wrongfulness the same way the McNaughton rule does, and determine that it is, in fact, that term is contrary to public morality. there are no further questions on AOE 1, Your Honor, the government will move to AOE 2. Under AOE 2, Your Honor, this court should look to see if the military judge abused his discretion in admitting the appellant's statement. The military judge's findings of fact should be accepted unless they are found to be clearly erroneous or unsupported by the record. And this court should look at the conclusions of law, the military judge's conclusions of law, de novo. Appellant gave a valid waiver. In this case, Your Honor, appellant does not contest the voluntariness of his statement. He concedes that his statement was voluntary. So we will only be looking at the knowing and intelligent aspect of that waiver. That waiver is the burden for that waiver come in as a preponderance of the evidence. And as the Supreme Court pointed out commonly, mental condition alone is not sufficient to render a confession involuntary. Indeed, there's only a simple understanding of your Miranda rights, as Colorado v. Spring points out, is necessary for an individual to waive their right to self-incriminate. All they need to
understand. Doesn't the defense agree with that here, based on the questions that we discussed with the defense? That is, the defense is not claiming that the existence of a mental illness renders the confession involuntary. The defense is focusing on the findings of the military judge in this case and the relationship of the findings of the 706 board to the determinations by the military judge. Is there a disagreement here between the parties on this?
No, I don't, Your Honor, I don't believe the defense is saying that. I think they're recognizing common. However, for lack of a better term, they're placing all their eggs in one basket. They're looking at the mental illness and saying that one facet, that one fact, trumps all the other facts that the military judge looked at in his determination.
And where did the military judge discuss the findings with respect to the specific mental illness and its impact on the accused's competency in this case?
In his findings of fact, Your Honor, is that what you're referring
to? In his findings of fact during this discussion, where does he grapple with the testimony that came in that the defense asked him to consider in this case?
Where does he grapple with it, Your Honor? Your Honor, are you asking, does he say that the appellant is not mentally competent or was not mentally competent at the time?
No, it was where does he take a look at what the 706 board and the other testimony that came in about his mental state at the time of the offense and at the issue that delayed the competency, his competency to stand trial. Where does the judge look at that and say, well, how does that affect his ability to understand what was going on in the waiver of rights?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the military judge says that expressly. He does not say that.
I don't think so either. Yeah.
No, Your Honor. However, the military judge did receive the entire record. He was aware of the competency hearing. A military judge received and looked at the DVD that this court actually has before it to observe the demeanor of the appellant during his interrogation. The military judge also had before him the facts of the appellant's age, his education, his conduct again during that interrogation where his demeanor would change. He tried to soften the language that was being put into the actual confession, showing that he recognized that he was looking to lessen his culpability. Additionally,
No, I understand the points that the government has made in its own independent review of the material. And my question is, if the judge didn't focus on the same things in his findings, why doesn't that render them erroneous in the circumstances of this case?
It does not, Your Honor, because there are multiple findings in the military judge's findings of fact. And each of those findings of fact are supported by the record. And the military judge, off of those findings of fact, renders his decision, which, based on those findings of fact, Your Honor, this court should not find that he abused his discretion in admitting that evidence. Only preponderance of the evidence was required for that statement to be voluntary and knowing. And the military judge looked at the evidence, is presumed to know the law, and rendered a decision, which was not an abuse of discretion. Again, the appellant concedes or agrees that the totality of the circumstances should be looked at. And the military judge did just that. He looked at the totality of the circumstances and determined that appellant had a simple understanding of the rights that were before him, his right to not self-incriminate. And he waived those rights. Further evidence of that is that the appellant, during his confession, actually granted the right to have his quarters searched. He understood that, and then at a later time, he rescinded that waiver for his quarters to be searched. If he can understand the right to not or to be searched, he can also understand the right to be silent or not to be silent.
Did he understand that he had the right to rescind it? Did he understand that he had the right to rescind his alleged consent to have his quarters searched?
It appears, Your Honor, the very fact that he rescinded his...
Oh, no, but I mean in the testimony when he was talking to the agents, didn't it appear that he was a little bit confused? Didn't he ask, well, can I withdraw it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wasn't he supposedly informed that he could rescind it just hours earlier?
Yes, Your Honor.
And doesn't that reflect some confusion?
It does, Your Honor. However, again, he answered quite. There is evidence of confusion or some confusion. There's some evidence of that, Your Honor. But however, when you look at his statements, his responses to statements, there are bizarre answers. There are. However, he gives logical, coherent answers. The military judge looked at this evidence, viewed this evidence. This court has the DVD before it as well, and this court can also see the appellant's demeanor during this confession. He understood what he was saying. He understood these simple rights, these simple statements.
Where in the military judge's findings did he address Dr. Sardoff's testimony that he wasn't competent to understand his rights when he waived them?
Your Honor, I don't believe in his actual findings he discusses specifically Dr. Sardoff's testimony.
And wouldn't that be a critical part of the totality of the circumstances? Dr. Sardoff was the only mental health expert that testified as to his ability to understand what he was doing.
Yes, Your Honor. However, we do know the military judge heard that testimony.
We do know that, but we don't know if he didn't address it in his findings, which are all we have to work with at this point.
Yes, Your Honor. However, we also know that Dr. Sardoff on... page 81 stated specifically that he believed that the appellant actually, I think his words were specifically that he intellectually understood what was taking place.
But that doesn't go to the fact that he had earlier testified that he wasn't competent to understand that he was waiving these rights.
Yes, Your Honor. However, he does come back and say that he intellectually understood, and he could respond to this question. So he gives conflicting testimony. However, again, that one piece of testimony is weighed in amongst the rest of the testimony that was given, or the rest of the circumstances that occurred with regards to this.
That's an interesting concept that you have. If a person actually, and we won't talk about this case, we'll just talk about a case where an individual absolutely was incompetent to understand the rights that he was waiving. How would you then balance that against the fact that he was literate or that he was 23 years of age or that he had gone to college for 2 years? What difference does that make if, in fact, from a medical perspective, he did not have the ability to understand?
Well, Your Honor, we don't have those facts under this case. However...
Okay, well, let's just assume that we did.
Well, Your Honor... Again, looking at Conley, we had someone who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia and was incompetent to stand.
Well, no, my question is, how do you balance those two? I mean, you said that the military judge here looked at everything, and that's fine. And you had earlier said in your argument that, the defense's argument is that they're relying, putting all of their eggs in one basket,
yes, sir,
that he was medically incompetent and unable to understand his rights. So my question is that if we were to assume that they're right, not saying that they are and not saying that we're going to rule that way, but let's just assume that they are, then what difference does it make that he had 3 years of college or that he could read and write? How do you balance that? I mean, I don't see, it just seems to be the apples and oranges almost.
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand your point, Your Honor, if you assume that all the eggs should be in the basket of if someone is mentally ill, and based on their mental illness, they are unable to participate in that confession or knowingly give that confession,
right.
then Your Honor, then I can appreciate your point. However, the government offers, again, that's not the state of the law. We look at mental illness as a factor. It may be a significant factor. However, it is a factor. And then we look at the totality of the circumstances. And the military judge did just that. And he rendered conclusions of law and he rendered findings of fact that were not clearly erroneous. And this court should not determine that his findings of fact were clearly erroneous or that he abused his discretion in admitting that confession.
Did he address anything other than police misconduct or the mere fact of mental impairment in his conclusions of law? The way I'm reading it, he's looking at Connolly and saying, well, you either have to have some kind of police involvement in rendering the statement involuntary, and by the way, the mere existence of a mental impairment isn't sufficient. Is there anything more to his conclusions than that?
Your Honor, may I see I've run out of
court.
Time. Yes, Your Honor. I think, Your Honor, what you're asking is regarding the voluntariness of the statement.
I'm trying to look at his conclusions as to what he based his conclusion that he was going to let the statement in on, and he's focusing on the issue of police misconduct. He's focusing on an understanding that mental impairment alone is not sufficient. But what I don't see in here is him focusing on the specific testimony in the case as to whether or not there was a knowing and intelligent decision at that point.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe what he says is that it's not a due process violation for the statement to come in. And a due process violation incorporates both voluntariness and knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, he's addressing implicitly the knowing element as well, Your Honor. And of course, finds of fact do discuss the appellant's age, his education, aspects that go towards the knowing element, Your Honor. Again, any military judge is presumed to know the law unless something is shown contrary to that. Again, a military judge factored in took into account all of these circumstances and rendered his decision, Your Honor. Again, this court should not find that decision was an abuse of discretion. To conclude, Your Honor.
I have one question.
Yes, sir.
How do you answer the appellant's contention on HBRD that, you know, I asked the appellant's counsel, why isn't this HBRD, even if it erroneously came in? And they said because it bulks too large and the trial counsel made too much of a use of it. How do you answer that question?
Well, Your Honor, we have a case where the appellant stormed a mess deck and stabbed a victim in front of numerous witnesses. The weapon was found. Eyewitnesses. This statement is cumulative, Your Honor. The strength of the government's case is overwhelming. And the witnesses that would actually come into the courtroom and testify that the appellant assaulted the victim is overwhelming.
What about the premeditation piece and the revenge piece? Doesn't that come in through the confession?
Well, it doesn't have to, Your Honor. The appellant was seen looking through the people in the galley. He was watching, lying in wait, waiting for his victim to come into the come into the mess deck. And then once he came onto the mess deck, he stealthily went up behind him, grabbed him, and began to plunge a knife into his belly and into his chest and slit his neck. Bottom line is that there is evidence of premeditation, Your Honor, and it is overwhelming.
But you don't disagree that the statement does add weight to the premeditation aspect of the case?
Your Honor,
The test isn't whether it's legally sufficient without it. You understand that?
Yes, Your Honor. But we look at it, I believe it's a Van Arsdale analysis, and we're looking at whether or not it's cumulative. And the government's position is
that's one aspect of it. But the ultimate test is whether or not we can be certain that it wouldn't have added to his conviction.
Your Honor, the government's position is that looking at a Van Arsdale analysis, when you look at the strength of the government's case, and you look at what is actually included in the statement, it is under that test. That statement is not necessary to obtain the conviction of the appellant in this case. To conclude, Your Honor, again, when defining moral wrongfulness, the courts have consistently applied the objective standard And no court since the IDRA has applied that subjective standard. This court should not blaze new law and follow appellant's invitation. And finally, Your Honor, again, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting appellant's confession.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the appellant.
Your Honor, I know that I exceeded my time in argument. Unless there are further questions from the court, I'll relinquish any remaining time.
Are there questions up here? Anybody up here? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for your argument today, and the court will stand in recess until, oh, no, math, 20 of the hour. Thank you very much.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:40.